The 9/11 question is very huge. The thing that I'm a New Yorker, and I've been doing all summer organizing, well, all year, but especially all summer organizing with New Yorkers Say No to War, and I've been doing media outreach for New Yorkers Say No to War. And on 9/11, we had an action where 300 people wearing Say No to War t-shirts were laying down on the ground in silence, and we handed out cards talking about the various different things we were mourning, including, of course, as New Yorkers, the loss of life and our sense of safety in the city, but also as global citizens, the murder of innocent civilians elsewhere in our names, and racial profiling and constitutional civil liberties rollbacks, and all of the different things we were mourning. And I can tell you that as the press contact on 9/11 in Union Square, which was the height of activity after 9/11 for victims' families and for peace activists alike. So we do this memorial, and I was bombarded with requests for interviews from reporters and videographers and photographers from Sweden and from Japan and from New Zealand and Australia and Aruba and Canada and France and a few others that I can't remember at the moment. And in terms of American media, I talked to NPR, who the reporter was somewhat hostile. Another member of New Yorkers Say No to War talked to the Dallas Morning News, and I think a local community paper from New Jersey. So the international, and that was it. The New York Times didn't send a reporter to Union Square. They did send a photographer, and she wanted nothing to do with the peace activism, which was the story in Union Square, but she wanted to train her camera on two women crying, and took about half a roll of film of two women crying, and didn't want to have to do with anything else other than the money shot. And to me, it was very typical. The world press said to me over and over, the woman from Aruba and the man from Sweden and the guy from Tokyo all said, it's so important for us to hear what you have to say here today, because outside your country, we don't know you exist. All we hear is what Bush is saying, and we hear your media reflecting that. Which, you know, it's, and the fact that we were in New York and the New York media and the national media didn't care that this news was going on was very typical. After 9/11, to bring it back to women though, I think that media coverage, corporate media coverage, was absolutely complicit in manufacturing a climate, a misleading and false climate of consent that said that the country, the public, as if the public is one monolithic group, was gung-ho in support for war. This very flag-waving, Rambo-esque notion of a public thirsty for blood. Poll stories like the Washington Post's, I think the headline was Public Unyielding in War Against Terror, and with subheads like 9 in 10 favor robust military response. When you looked at the poll story, though, it was really interesting. The very end of the story, after the jump on page, you know, whatever double-digit page in the back of the paper, at the tail end of the story, it was determined that, in fact, the public was not monolithic. They didn't say it in those terms. What they said was, there are pockets of hesitancy when you ask deeper questions. For example, women, when asked if they supported military action, 44% of women said they supported some form of military action, and 48% of women said they supported little to no military action at all. And no one picked that up of the major papers in the country. I did a Nexus search. The only major outlet that picked that up was Salon, an online magazine, and I couldn't find it. But you could find Bush's approval rating, which was the 9 in 10. It wasn't that everybody wanted war, it was that people were supporting the president, which was, there is a distinction there. The idea that 44% of women were invested in potentially supporting some form of action, where more than that wanted nothing to do with it, was absolutely absent from the mainstream media dialogue. And this is in the first month, when between the aftermath of the attacks and before the bombing. You had any number of other poll stories that showed the same type of thing. When you ask qualifying questions, which they didn't ask very often, and reporters, once the pollsters asked it, reporters ignored the answers. But when you asked qualifying questions, women specifically continually said that there was a huge gender gap in women's support for war. That if, when you ask women, do you support war, or would you support war if it would lead to an economic downturn in the country, if it would kill American soldiers, if it would lead to civilian casualties elsewhere, if it would, any if that was a negative response from war, resulted in anywhere from a 9 to a 30-point drop in women's support. And yet all the pundits that we heard, all of the op-eds that we read, said that they're specific, either ignored women entirely as if there was no difference of opinion because women didn't even need to enter the debate, or they said, without any evidence at all, that there was no gender gap and that this was somehow different from every other past war where there was a gender gap, where women were more pacifist and more likely to be doves. That was a particularly crucial failure in our media that helped the Bush administration beat the drums for war in such a way that that Congress was able to say, look, the public, everybody wants us to do this. At the same time, you had women being used, Afghan women, oppressed Afghan women, being used in the most jaded and cynical ways by corporate media as tools, propaganda tools, I believe, for the war effort. Groups like the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan and the Feminist Majority here and other feminist groups had for 5 years been trying, to very little avail, to get the mainstream media to pay any attention at all to what they called gender apartheid in Afghanistan. Huge campaigns, any different multi-strategy campaigns, hardly made any dent in media coverage. But once 9/11 happened, the tone changed. Once they decided they needed some sort of Western-friendly reason to go to war, then they started saying, well, look, it's horrible, they have to wear burqas. Look, it's horrible, the girls can't go to school. They didn't focus so much, which is, I'm not downplaying that is definitely vast oppression, but the media didn't actually cover in any significant, I don't want to say any, media didn't generally cover in significant measure the more immediate, more health-threatening, and more life-threatening oppressions that Afghan women were facing under the Taliban, including the fact that if you are, for example, going to be punished in punitive and violent ways for walking outside without a male relative, but you live in a region where most of your male relatives have been killed in war, that means you're homebound for life. They didn't talk a whole lot about women dying in their houses because they weren't able to get to hospitals because they weren't admitted during childbirth, all these things. They didn't talk about the types of vast war crimes committed by the Northern Alliance, before they were the Northern Alliance, against women, the mass rapes, the beatings, etc., that were one of the many reasons that the Taliban came into power in the first place. The reason I believe that media didn't go into much depth about Afghan women's oppression, but focused on it a lot in the ways that we could sort of in the West get our minds around, that would outrage us enough to say, yeah, go liberate the chicks, but not outrage us enough to ask for follow-up, right? If they talked about women being homebound, if they talked about all of these very serious life-threatening oppressions that women were facing right at that moment, then as citizens, the chances are we would be demanding the government and demanding the media to follow up with those stories and do something for these women after our bombing raids ended, right? But instead, our media were just able to run triumphant visuals of a few women taking off their burqas and said, look, we liberated the women. Now we're done. How many stories do we read right now about Afghan women and their plight? Did we read, for example, that right when they were having all these conversations about what the government in Afghanistan would be like after the UN and the US were trying to figure out who to install, etc., there was an Afghan women's summit where they came up with a proclamation that was really intense, very comprehensive, incredibly detailed. You can find it, I believe, on Eve Ensler's V-Day site. You can find it on the Women for Afghan Women site. You can find it in the newspaper Sojourner, the feminist Sojourner, the Women's Forum, which is a feminist newspaper in Boston. They included media, and they included education, they included health, they included environmental issues, they included so many detailed strategy sessions, strategy points, outreach. They knew what they need in that country, and that was not represented anywhere in corporate media. And the story has basically been dropped. We don't read about the fact that women in Rawa, for example, are saying that Afghan women are not well served with the Northern Alliance in power. They're nervous and they're scared that they're going to be the victims of mass rape again. So I guess what I would say about media coverage, I can and have talked about this on end, and I don't want to take away time from the rest of the women on the panel, because I know we all have a variety of perspectives. So I guess to sum up, what I will say is that the issue is very, this is not so different from how women are covered in general. It's a different topic, but if the panel today was about coverage of women in globalization and the fact that women are 90% of the world's sweatshop workers, women and girls, but sweatshops and global trade are not necessarily considered by media, are very rarely at all considered by media a feminist issue or a women's issue. Any number of those types of issues, we could give you these types of stories about these issues. What we need to start doing, I think, is holding media accountable for underrepresenting women's voices consistently and for considering women's stories and women's issues to be just things that affect the body or things that affect kids, so that we start to demand that media cover the world as if women are truly invested citizens in the world, and that women's perspectives are universal in the same way that men's perspectives are universal to corporate media, so that it's not just abortion and rape and childcare that you might call a woman for if you need a source, that it's globalization and it's trade and it's war and peace. And I didn't have time to mention the statistic issue, so I'm just going to do that really quickly, which is that just at the same time as you had all those poll stories, you had the pundits who were saying there was no gender gap were almost predominantly male. I did a survey of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and USA Today in the month after 9/11, and found that women wrote, it's on my piece of paper, I don't remember if it was 8 or 9% of the bylined op-eds in that month. 8 or 9%. The White House Project is a women's leadership, nonpartisan women's leadership group, found that women after 9/11 were, I believe, 9% of the guests on 5 very influential Sunday morning talk show and debate shows. These types of, the fact that women, if we want to know why the gender gap went unreported, it's like you just do a college style drinking game, turn on the TV and put your mocha or your alcohol, depending on what you drink, in front of you and flip on Sunday morning, just flip through the talk shows, and every time you see a woman take a drink, you're gonna be so thirsty. I'm telling you, do it on the nightly news. They media affair and Fair's Magazine Extra ran an article a few months back by a woman named Ina Howard from a group called Media Tenor, and found that women were, I believe, 19% of all sources, 19% of all sources in every nightly news broadcast on the three networks in all of 2001. And that, even that overrepresents the notion of women's power in this broadcast, because of those 19% of women, they were vastly overrepresented as non-expert people on the street or just average citizens, what do you think? Whereas the men who were talked to in expert capacities. So that's my take.
Thank you. I think maybe I'll try to focus this 9/11, post-9/11 question on the issue of civil liberties and immigrant rights and detention, expansion of the INS, expansion of immigration enforcement, you know, post 9/11, and then over the years, sort of like where it's gone in the media. Just right before I came, I think I was reading an editorial, I don't know if any of you saw, was it Wednesday or the day before, September 11th, New York Times ran an editorial kind of denouncing the civil liberties crisis, right? And the way they framed it was that though we may not know, most of us do not know these people, you know, people who are affected, the 12,000 or so people who have been detained and deported, we don't know them, right? They're like mostly undocumented visa violators, or, you know, had some sort of like terrorist connection or what have you. So again, like their audience, you know, doesn't know these people, but it's still, it's a bad thing. It affects us, you know, it's bad for the Constitution, bad for the country. And I think like that's sort of where I noticed the dialogue has sort of drifted or towards, that the mainstream of the national media has taken more of a critical, you know, at least around the issue of civil liberties, and talking about unconstitutionality and so on, and demanding names of those who have been detained. Whereas, you know, right after September 11th, they were nowhere to be found on that, right? And, you know, it was complete secrecy with no real outcry on the media's part. So that, I guess, has been an improvement, even though maybe, you know, the problem there is that it's framed as a problem of civil liberties and only, and not an issue of racial justice and of immigrant rights, right? Because the people who are affected are not just the 1,200, you know, unnamed individuals that are now like expelled out of the country and that are connected to 9/11 or whatever. It's really a war against immigrants, and that's kind of how we're trying to recut that debate. And I think like encouraging to me also is, you know, what's the content you see in the ethnic press, because that's where there has been a lot more motion, a lot more new and interesting coverage that you wouldn't see. I think like the Pakistani press has been interesting in New York. A friend of mine was saying that they're, you know, they're totally politicized around issues of detention and deportation because the communities have been devastated. I think the Korean press, I've noticed a lot of like them breaking stories on Korean immigrants who've been now been targeted for INS raids because they're undocumented. And so there's been like a real spillover of effect on communities of color that it doesn't really get captured in the national dialogue, I don't think. So, I mean, I would say, you know, it's somewhat encouraging. I think there's some excitement as far as like opportunities for media activists to cover these stories. What was I gonna say? But I think also that, you know, internally, it's important for us to sort of make the conceptual linkages between what's happening now and sort of what's been in effect. So there, you know, that there has been a real infrastructure prior to 9/11, and 9/11 sort of like opened the door for all of that, you know, to happen. But you know, back in 96, they were able to do all of this when the immigration legislation happened, right, and the welfare reform in 96. So that deportations have been happening among the Latino community, and now, you know, it's starting to happen within the Southeast Asian community as well. So for us at Color Lines, I think part of the strategy to address some of this might be that, I mean, we take a little bit of that kind of, you know, mainstream journalism approach is how I think of it, because I was taught that you do that, you put a personal face to a story, you get the human, you know, connection and all of that. So I think the national media is doing that, but you see their stories about these immigrants who are, you know, being deported or detained or what have you, are really focus on the good immigrants, right? And it's, you know, this is amazing to me, but there's this whole kind of like story that I'm fascinated by, where on the one hand you might see stories of, you know, say a Pakistani man who's been married to a white American woman and has like a good job and, you know, all of this, and then the detail, you know, they always include as well, he messed up, he had a visa violation and they never, you know, fixed it, and now he's illegal and so he's being deported. And but the story is sympathetic because, you know, he was a hardworking immigrant, he was married to a citizen, and, you know, he had a job and everything. And so that leaves you with what happens to, you know, the people who, the migrants who've come here to work and people who committed crimes and are now deportable. So that area is, you know, completely kind of like unexplored, and nobody's sort of like taking that in, saying, well, you know, it's not really about these people, it's about kind of the policies that are very, you know, horrible and have caught a lot of people within their net. So then again, the challenge for us is when we do these human interest type of stories, is to not fall into that trap of, you know, saying like some people are deserving immigrants and some people are not. But the interesting little tidbit I'll just add to that, the whole marriage to an immigrant story, is we had heard some of our interns over the summer had heard of another flip side to that of women who had married immigrant men and were using their, you know, the new post 9/11 environment to get divorces, better like divorce settlements for themselves, saying, you know, well, I'm afraid of my husband. He's, you know, he's a terrorist, or he might be a terrorist. So, yeah, you know, on the one hand, there's like how being married to a white citizen can be, you know, beneficial, I guess, in some ways in terms of trying to get sympathy from the INS, and then on the other hand, how it's being the whole racialization of that, you know, I'm married to a terrorist.
Sounds like a B-movie book cover, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I think the other strategy for us has been to take an offensive tack as far as putting a face to the INS. So one piece that I've been trying to do is a hit piece, basically, on one of these regional INS directors. And we thought, you know, like, INS, it's so huge, what a huge target, and it's faceless, you know. But at the ground level of it is, you know, these regional offices where you have directors, and, you know, there's all sorts of different situations in every region, which I found out when we did a research project this summer in 5 different states in the South. And each region was kind of nuts, you know, in itself, and the INS is going through all of this craziness, too. With restructuring. So you have like the real like iron fist, true. But on the other hand, they're so disorganized that at the regional level, this devolutionized kind of authority, the regional directors were able to, you know, either like some places it would be better than others. And then some places, you know, they had people just changing leadership all the time. And so immigrant advocates in the area would say, well, we have nobody to hold accountable because it's always like a new person in office every few months, you know, so it varies. And so my idea was that we would try to kind of like just do, you know, one of these profile type of stories that you see a lot in the media, and we had this great, you know, great subject in this dude in Kentucky who, you know, on the one hand, like, he was totally accessible to immigrant communities and everybody was really afraid of him and everything, and so they were reluctant to say anything negative about him. So he was like this jolly, grandfatherly kind of figure, had this open door policy, but on the other hand was driving, like personally driving a lot of the kind of the enforcement, you know, attitude of his agents, the collusion with the police that was taking place, where they would, you know, have the police acting as immigration officers, basically, in their stops, you know, would call up the INS, call up the FBI, deport people for traffic violations, and that's happening like so commonly. So, you know, like, let's do a hit piece on this guy and put a face to it, that kind of thing. And then I think the other story that doesn't get covered on the offensive end is taking on this collusion of enforcement towards immigrants. Because I think, you know, it's reported in pieces. I'd like to see like a real comprehensive analysis of that, because I hear such like, you know, new ways that they're using. So everything from local police, you know, acting as INS agents, to, you know, the ATF in Texas. That was one story we heard. The INS and the ATF were going in together to get like Sikh store owners, you know, who were stocking weapons or guns in their store. Yeah, it's kind of like a lot of people were doing that because they had to defend, you know, from robberies. And then also I think like the something in the Sikh religion, I'm not too knowledgeable about that, but about carrying a weapon as part of the Sikh religion, just kind of like a knife or a ceremonial kind of thing. And so they were using the ATF to, you know, get them on weapons, illegal weapons possession. Or, you know, the case of the DMV right now in California, that's going down where, you know, immigrant rights groups are trying to get licenses for people. And as a caveat to that, now, you know, in this environment, they've tacked on all of these criminal background checks for people. And so to get your license, you have to pay you know, yourself to have the INS and the DMV run a background check. And consequently, it's opened up this door between the DMV and the INS. And, you know, originally just to sort of like provide information for the INS to do their checks, but how it's played out on the ground is that INS has used it to get people's, you know, home addresses. They have this thing called Operation Tarmac in California. I don't know if it's like spread around a lot.
It is.
So they raided a bunch of airport workers at the airport, but then they also got picked up people at their homes. And how they did it was they went through the DMV and got their home addresses. So I'd like to see, like, you know, just a more like attention paid to the collusion and the ways that, you know, institutions are collaborating in this new type of racial profiling, right, that's happening. So I'm kind of like ranting. Let me just, I'll stop there.
Thanks, Chan.
Yeah, I don't know how much more I can add to both of those. I think they're pretty comprehensive, and I think a lot of us here as journalists or media activists probably are very well aware of how the media has not served any community interests, be it before 9/11 or after 9/11, and I think that just extends out the challenge to all of us even more. It's so huge what we have to do. There's just such a huge gap, and what Tran's saying, you know, we need, like, there are so many issues that now even more so aren't being covered, and so many voices that now more so aren't even being covered, and I think it's a challenge for all of us. I think we really have to break out of how we've been able to go ahead as community media makers, and we actually have to challenge ourselves and bring in strategies and voices that maybe are hard for us ourselves to hear, that maybe challenge what we do on a daily basis, that maybe make us think outside of the box, because what's happening right now is not working. And I'm sure, like a lot of what Jen was saying, those statistics, they're crazy. You know, you think about it and you're like, wow, you know, what hope do we have? And I think if you apply that even further to the Muslim, Arab, and South Asian community right now, where do you even see them on television? Where do you even see their voices or hear what they have to say besides the one-off pieces of, you know, here's this one family and isn't this, oh, what a horrific story, and how can we let this happen? How do we take that and how do we make that? This is about racial injustice. This has been happening in Black and Latino communities for however long. This has been happening on lower levels in other communities of color. How do we take that ourselves and empower the people who are being affected by that to stand up there and powerfully tell their stories? And to not do it from a point of view where we go in and we put a microphone in front of them, or we go in and we write their story for them. Let's teach them. Let's leave them with tools so that they can tell their own story, so that they can continue to tell their own story, so that they can stand up, be it in front of the New York Times or be it in front of, you know, a community indie media journalist. Maybe their accent is hard to understand. Maybe their English is not good English. But we need to be putting implements into their hands, microphones, pens, give them internet access, empower communities to actually be able to tell it over and over and over again, so it becomes part of our mainstream. And the whole theory of the trickle up. If it's in, you know, what Tran's saying, yes, the Pakistani and South Asian press in New York City has taken a really radical detour in the last year. It's been really incredible. You know, these are communities that, working class communities especially, that, you know, have never really been hugely political in the content of ethnic press. You should read it now, you know, and that is what's, if we intensify that, if we go to them and want to listen as opposed to the way that it's been happening in community and alternative media, that's going to trickle up. They're going to be the makers of the news, and to me that's the challenge that's before us. Just to finish really quickly, I also have been researching a lot about the detention issue, and in doing it for radio, I think you encounter a few different elements than when you do it for print. And you see the same journalists on this detainee circuit. You know, you go out to the rallies, there are the certain community organizers who are helping you, who go out to visit, and it's been really fascinating to watch both community journalists and I think the closest we got to mainstream was an NPR journalist, a WNYC journalist, who just wanted the one story of the one man who was actually guilty of a crime out of the 612 cases that this one community advocate had. That's the story she wanted. But, you know, why are we surprised by that? But the community journalists, you know, it made me really sad. It made me really step back and examine what I do. You know, am I in there for a juicy story? Why am I there? And what voice am I trying to get out? Am I going to respect the fact that, and this might surprise you all, am I going to respect the fact that this person doesn't want their name put on there? That am I going to respect the fact that I'm just going to put their voice out there, even though their English isn't good? But that's their voice. I don't want to put a translation over the top. The more we hear that, the more we'll understand it. So there are so many issues that we're indie media and community media journalists, we have to learn to respect, and we have to learn from the people who we're working with. So that's my addition to 911.
Well, there's a lot just said here, so I don't want to repeat anything that was said, but to kind of follow up on what she was just saying, I think there's a lot of truth to the need to kind of get out of our comfort zones a little bit more, especially with progressive movements. I think there's sort of a, you know, an orthodoxy that we follow in a certain sense, like these are the bad guys, these are the good guys, you know, the good guys do this, 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 and this, you know, they're vegetarians, they don't drive cars, they don't watch television, they read books, they listen to NPR, you know, they do all these good things. And if you're talking about diverse communities, the communities that I work with, communities that, you know, Trim and all these people work with, it's not so clear cut. You know, we have business owners, we have people who do believe in capitalism, we have people who meet, we have people who do all kinds of things that are not part of sort of the progressive world, unfortunately. And I think at some point, you know, we're going to have to take a really big step back and say, okay, we keep talking about wanting a diverse movement of progressive people to be working with us to this goal. Okay, well, let's look around. You know, are we that? And why not? If we're not, then we need to look at all the ways in which our sort of worldview is contributing to that, and maybe ask some really hard questions about that. That's my little speech on that. But speaking of post 9/11, I think definitely I totally agree with all the comments that were made about the dismal state of media reporting. Absolutely, but I do see some positive things that came out of that. Especially in communities of color, there has been a pretty big radicalization, I think, in a lot of communities that were a little bit more shy and a little bit less inclined to step out there and really take a stand on things. And I've seen a lot of that this past year. I've also seen a lot of cross-cultural organizing that has been really heartening. I've seen a lot of groups come together and work together and really take up for other people's issues, which is something I don't think really saw too much of before. Last year as much. I also think that there's kind of an overall crash course in whatever you want to say about the coverage, bad, good, or whatever. People have been forced to think for the first time, some of them, about South Asia, about Islam, and this includes people of color who didn't know, you know, a Muslim from a Sikh, or you know, a Hindu from a Muslim, or all these different facets of our world that were just kind of big blank spots. You know, people are being forced into the position of at least knowing a tiny bit about it, and that's, I think, progress. One thing I also wanted to say is, in this unpopular viewpoint at a conference like this, but I don't think that, coming from a background in mainstream newspapers, and that's all I can say about, I'm sure broadcast is completely different, but coming back from a background in mainstream newspapers, what you have in mainstream newspapers are a bunch of individuals, people who, for whatever reason, their upbringing are just like everybody else in the country. They're ignorant about a whole bunch of different things. They come from a largely middle class, largely white, very pro-business standpoint. but they're not a lost cause. And what I would say about people in mainstream newspapers is there are people in mainstream newspapers that can be used to further the agendas that we're talking about here. Get to know those people. Look for articles that you don't think are half bad in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. Set up a meeting with one of those reporters. Develop a relationship. Don't just assume because they work for the PI they're bad and that you should just write them off. They could help you get to the goals that you're trying to achieve for your organization, or even, you know, alternative media. And don't just act like it's a lost cause, because I don't think it is. Because knowing those people and knowing that they're just as, you know, frail in some senses as everybody else, they just need to learn. They need to know your perspective, not be screamed at, but they need to know your perspective so they can come on board. And just want to throw their ad there before, you know, we just give up on them entirely. So that's my little speech.
Thank you for your comments. Now at this time, last 10 minutes of the session, I'd like to throw it out some questions people have up there.
I was doing a media analysis recently of CNN, and something really struck me, because I haven't watched TV in like 4 years. All of the anchors that I saw were women, and like 3/4 of them were women of color, and I was like, okay, CNN. So it must still be bad. This is really weird. But I wanted to know what you thought about that. If it actually changes the way anything is reported, if it's tokenism, if it's just strange. Because it really shocked me that they were there.
Can I say something about that? I think it's totally tokenism. I think that's, it shows no progress whatsoever. I mean, I think you really have to listen to what people say. And if you notice any, I don't know who exactly you're talking about, but if you listen to what they say, I'm sure it didn't vary that much from what the other people were saying. That's just my view.
Can I add to that? It's a couple years ago, a study was done by Joe Foote at the University of, I think it's the University of Illinois, does them every few years, of gender and racial breakdowns of news anchors. And what was interesting to me was that and then also another study, a lot of studies monitor this type of thing. A World Association of Christian Communication study of global media, like media in every country they could find people to monitor on a certain day, found that by and large, women were not the subjects of news, and by and large, people of color weren't the subjects of news, and the news wasn't told from their perspective, but that the notion, the presentation was such that we were trying to, in mainstream media, trying to present this idea that there is more diversity in media than there is, so that you had much more gender and racial equity. Not, you didn't have equity, but you had a closer representation in terms of numbers of women and people of color in anchor positions, reading out the words that other people write for them. But at the same time, what Naomi said before about don't write off your average reporter, I forgot to mention that after, just an anecdote I think would be useful, after the protest in Union Square where everybody was lying on the ground, a few of us walked down to Ground Zero in Say No to New Yorker Say No to War t-shirts and tried to do that kind of very grassroots, just individual one-on-one communications with people and with reporters, that kind of really in your face education. And there was one woman reporter from CNN who was stationed right outside of the, they blocked off Ground Zero except for the victim families, but as close as you could go, there were just hundreds of people swarming around, putting the flowers down and the memorials of the faces. And she was stationed there, that's where she had to be the whole time. And she saw our shirts and was really open. She was a Latino reporter, Maria Hinojosa, actually, was the woman. She was really open. She really wanted to do an interview with us. We waited for an hour for her. That's the other thing, is if you find a reporter that's open, you have to work with them, because they have, you know, so she didn't know when she was going to be able to do it. We said we could stay. Eventually, it turned out that they cut 2 minutes out of her live feed, so she couldn't do a talking interview with us, but she made sure to after she did the interview with the fireman's widow, turns the camera to us, said, and there are other people here today, these women, and they showed the shirts, which was declarative enough, and she said, and she read the name of the group, and you know, said that there are other messages, people working for peace and saying no to war. And And the thing that I, the thing that was stood out for me about that is that there really are people, especially women, especially people of color, who are trying to get good and positive stories out there, but they're working within a biased institutional structure. No one inside the newsroom wants to be seen as the troublemaker. It's career threatening. So they face the same types of problems that whistleblowers face in corporate America. But at the same time, just because you have a woman at the table or a person of color at the table doesn't mean you're necessarily getting a better. I mean, Cokie Roberts after 9/11 on Letterman said, "I'm just a sucker for those boys in for the boys in uniform." She made this. She talked about how she had the Joint Chiefs of Staff, former Joint Chiefs of Staff, on this week with Sam and Cokie, and she's like, "I just couldn't even lift his jacket. It had so many medals. So you know, when they tell me something, I'm ready to believe it." Death of journalism. Is it better for us that we have Cokie Roberts? Is this a feminist or a progressive thing because Cokie Roberts is a sucker for the boys at the Pentagon? So, you know, it's a complex thing, this diversity issue.
Deepa, you had a comment.
Just really quickly, I'd also just say that that we also suffer from, Maria Hinojosa is a beautiful example. I have been monitoring over the last couple of weeks network news just for the work that I've been doing. And I would say Maria Hinojosa started as one of us. She was a lefty progressive community journalist. She was at WBAI in New York City. She's in CNN now. What does being in CNN mean? It means you can do that kind of thing, but you can't forget that you. It also means that you internalize it, and you put it back out. The last story that I saw of Maria Hinojosa the day before September 11, she was reporting about victims of 9/11. Okay, everyone was reporting about victims of 9/11. So maybe her little bit was to actually get one Latino guy in there. So it was probably the only person of color that I saw that was a victim in all that news coverage. But Maria Hinojosa herself, she did, it's almost like the colonized mentality of we can have these people of color reporters, these women of color, but what's coming out of our mouths? She described the two white people on either side, words like gorgeous and strikingly beautiful. Mm. And the Latino man and his family, it was a mother with her six kids who's been left. She was sitting there, this like the photo was this like plump woman with her like one baby. It just furthered every single stereotype, and she didn't have a single nice word to say about this woman. And they were her words. And I know that Maria Hinojosa writes her own words. So I think we just really have to be careful about, you know, when we look at people of color who are there, that, you know, they're being puppeteered by the people on top as well. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to comment?
No. I just wonder if folks could respond to sort of the same observation that Jen made earlier about that women's voices as sources of media don't exist for what are perceived as non-gendered issues. They're not talking about globalization or trade or corporate corruption or those kind of things. Could you respond to that as just other than white voices are also not views for things other than right now it's maybe it's okay that we talk to some, you know, Muslim because, you know, we have to because 9/11, but we're not going to talk to them about anything else other than just are they afraid of racial profiling in the United States or something like that. Speak to any of those kinds of issues since the last year or so.
Do you want to comment on that, Jen?
Yeah, I think that there's
definitely true. The phenomenon that Jen is talking about is true across the board for, I think, all underrepresented groups. You talk to an African-American person when an African-American person's been, you know, assaulted or shot or, you know, some sort of, it's only when it's a race issue are people of color included in the conversation. That's a huge problem for the media. And I don't know if, you could just take that exact same example she used for women and apply it to people of color and you'd find the same thing. I don't think there's a big difference there.
Let me add a little to that. I don't know if you know, like Knight Ridder has this policy where all of their reporters have to, like, after every story you tally how many sources were, you know, people of color, and, you know, was so-and-so African-American, was so-and-so Latino, and so on. Any story, right? And so some of my friends work for Knight Ridder, and we had this discussion about that. And, you know, on one hand, like, some reporters are griping about this because they're like, well, you know, it's bean counting, and, you know, what has it really gotten us? And, it, you know, it becomes like this bureaucratic detail that they have to do after every story. Well, did you get three, you know, like, Latinos or whatever? And so I think, like, it's, you know, it's sort of an interesting thing for me that, like, Knight Ridder is taking on this institutional way to, you know, to mandate that they try to get more voices of people of color to be, you know, experts, right, the way the media approaches it, experts on whatever issue. But then, you know, I'm always more interested in the content of it and the politics of what they're saying. And, you know, you could go and just as easily get, like, Gregory Rodriguez or, you know, some really conservative Latino voices, right, and it doesn't really get you anywhere else. So being nationalistic about it doesn't, you know, like, what's the ultimate goal of that? So, yeah, I'd say, like, I guess the luxury of being a small, specialized, you know, publication is that we can kind of leave that behind and just take on the media, the national media, where, you know, we can and pick fights with them where we can. But I still think, I mean, I think, you know, it's valid to say that we incorporate women and women of color and people of color into our worldview, right, as a more, you know, holistic way of, like, looking at issues.
Actually, we're about out of time, unfortunately, and I just want to comment that, yeah, this is a really great panel, even for me, and as editor of the Examiner, I really do feel myself that I have a lot of learning to do about different cultures and different issues.
Tomorrow between 11 and noon, we're running in the park, I think it is, a workshop for how to become a stringer for our newscast. Mm. And I would love it if all of you could, especially if you're from here, from Seattle, if you could go out, if you could bring a young person of color who has, you know, who would really benefit from having a microphone put in their hand so that we can really, in a good solid session, hopefully get some really diverse stringers working for us out of Seattle. That would be really great.
Can I add one thing too? Really quick. We talked a lot about the underrepresentation of women and people of color's voices in media, and we also talked a lot about giving people tools to counteract that. That's what I'm trying to do with the organization I'm starting. So if you have interests in those topics, please get in touch with me. I've got some flyers over here, and I'd love to hear from you.
Okay, I'd like to give a round of applause for